Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi. Yes, I'm Steven, but today I wish to be known for my lucha libre name, El Libertador. Anyway, each episode we here at Sci-Fi review a different science fiction or fantasy novel, then come back for a complete spoiling. And we have quite a novel for you here this week. What's in store today, Barry?
Today we're reviewing Colony, a 1978 novel by Ben Bova.
That's right, which is part of an unintentional two-part series we did about science fiction in the late 70s.
Was the series unintentional?
Oh, hell yeah.
Or did we unintentionally read the second part first?
Both!
Yay! Let's skip the first part.
Thank you, Audible.
So, what does it say on the back of this book?
Back of the book says, quote, Island One is a celestial utopia, and David Adams is its most perfect creation. A man with a brain as advanced as any computer and a body free of human frailties. But David is a prisoner, a captive of the colony that created him, destined to spend the days of his life in an island-sized cylinder that circles a doomed and desperate home planet. Thousands of miles below him, a world trembles. Its people cringe in terror and despair in anticipation of an impending apocalypse, and fate has cast one extraordinary human in the role of a savior. For David Adams has a plan, one that will ultimately ensure the salvation of his species, or its annihilation. I know which one I'm rooting for.
Annihilation.
I always vote for annihilation. Mm.
It comes first in the alphabet. Anyway, yes, based on that kind of summary, I was expecting a fun story about a super advanced space colony.
I was expecting a science fiction story.
That too, yes.
It happened at the very end.
Yeah, I figured that our main character would be this super smart, genetically engineered cyborg who would use his mathematical powers of prediction to save humanity.
Oh, he used his cyborgness to look up Google searches.
Yeah, our main character is a muscled, bland, and mostly forgettable idiot that people keep on praising to be a genius. The side characters are either horrifying caricatures or vapid love interests. There's no plot in the standard sense. It's more like a 70s movie where the main character stumbles from one bizarre situation to another. And towards the end, there's a fun science fiction action movie that just about starts, and then David does something stupid, and then the novel ends.
Gratefully.
Yes, I'm not complaining about that last bit. So, the only way I got through it was to pretend that I was watching a low-budget 70s B-movie on VHS. Ben Bova has written over 100 other books. Read one of them instead.
Yeah, I really, after you mentioned that, I really wanted to see sort of the 70s miniseries version of this.
With Mr. T as Leo.
Yeah, that I would have actually enjoyed that version of it. As it was, this book was like hours and hours of like audio torture.
John Saxon as Dr. Cobb.
I think at one point I sat down one evening and sat there for what I felt was about 3 hours listening to this book, and when I looked at the elapsed time, it was only about 30 minutes, and I was...
You were just crying in the corner.
I was a little despondent. I'd have
dilation.
To say, with the amount of progress I had made. But
see, physics works.
I will give this book one big kudo. It's made me appreciate other books so much more.
Yeah, the only way I got through this was I was busy doing manual labor, and I needed to listen to something, and I put it at 2.5 times speed, and it still seems slow. Normally, I can't go over maybe 1.5 times without it being completely unintelligible, and the narrator did us the great gravitas feature of making it like really, really exciting with pauses, and you're just like, seriously? Even at 2.5 times speed, there were long pauses.
Was the narrator that kid from Malcolm in the Middle, the one who can't speak?
No, the narrator was Christopher Tabori, and unfortunately not actually William Shatner.
Yeah, I mean, if it was William Shatner, I probably would have enjoyed it just for the bizarreness of it. And it's not like this guy is a bad narrator. It's just that maybe this wasn't the best choice for this book if you didn't like it. If you did like it, you'd be like savoring every glorious, like, drawn-out moment of it.
Oh, wait, no, I take it back. Featuring William Shatner as Dr. Cobb.
I don't know, Lindsay Wagner as the reporter or something?
Yeah, that would be good. Well, time for us to put on our turtlenecks, grow out our sideburns, and disco dance our way to the spoiler zone. We'll be back, for we are sci-fi.
Sci-fi.
Sci-fi. Chicka-bow-wow.
All right, welcome back to the spoiler zone, where we will do our best to spoil the hell out of Colony so no one will ever have to read it. I should warn people that this was a pretty triggery book, so we're going to be talking about some pretty offensive things. If you want to sit this one out, feel free. Barry, would you please fill people in on what happens in this book?
No, I don't want to.
You pick this one.
And?
You're genetically mandated to.
Okay, fine. This book was billed as Earth's last chance to escape into orbit onto a series of orbiting space stations, the first being Island One. In reality, this book is about how easily a genetically engineered human, David, is radicalized and turned into a quasi-freedom fighter for the PRU, along with his super-hot side-squeeze, Bajat, also known as Scheherazade. There are a number of other factions in the war against the world government, the African-American contingent being the most prominent. The book basically devolves into an old white man worst nightmare come true, when the African-American PRU contingent attacks Manhattan and immediately commits an interracial rape scene. It's straight out of a Tea Party nightmare script book.
Fun.
Oh, yes.
Okay. And speaking of tea, let's get our usual questions over with. Was there tea?
A whole bunch. Even a tea shop, like in the first 10 minutes.
There might have even been euphemisms involving tea.
Yeah, yeah. There was a lot of tea, and it almost made me not like tea anymore.
Almost.
Almost.
But only when it comes with a gypsy girl.
Yeah, there was this whole scene where one of our supposedly heroic characters, Denny McCormick, ogles a gypsy girl outside of a tea shop, and then at some point reveals that she's preteen.
I believe she's 14.
She's 15, I think, according to the thing. But
early teens. But uncomfortable.
He's like a phoebophile action.
Yeah, yeah, it was sort of this creepy thing where he was sort of saying how great she was, and then he's like, oh, and then she's 15, and then he like gives her money for her dancing, and he's like, oh, but I'm not expecting anything else.
Just for the dancing.
And she's like, no, it's bad luck, and also, you're totally creepy. Like,
well, it's played that, oh, well, I'm not going to take your money because everybody knows that people are going to try to kill you soon.
Right.
Except for you. You didn't apparently know that.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. That was Denny, the eventual love interest of Scheherazade or Bajat, who is basically there to be a kind of a Western idiot and then to be killed so that Bajat has some kind of motivation for a while because she can't just be a freedom fighter.
Maybe they marked him for death because he was a ginger.
Yes. Okay, next glorious question. And this may be the final asking of this question because I think that the 70s have ruined it for me.
It's not just you.
Was there an uncomfortable sex scene?
Let me count the number.
So many. And
I believe the term was underwater baton twirling.
Yeah, we had 15 different types of dubiously consensual sex going on. Also, I think that this particular book has the record for answering all of our questions the fastest. We had first an uncomfortable sex scene, then a tea shop scene.
I think there was an honorable mention for the first solo awkward sex scene, which involved, quote, involuntary masturbation.
Ooh. I don't even know what that is.
I don't
want to know.
Don't make me get the clip out.
We'll be good. Anyway, all right. Neat, fun, glorious. Hey,
thanks for ruining it for everybody else.
It seemed like every time they're like, we got to really hammer it in that this character, the Texas millionaire, billionaire guy, is bad. First, the Pearl Divers. They were a gift. It's okay. How long can they hold their breath underwater? It's just like a string of horribly written puns or something.
Yeah, well, Kevin is referring to T. Hunter Garrison, a vaguely Texas-seeming, creepy multinational leader who basically seems to be there to skeeve out the narrative even further somehow.
Push it to volume 11.
And yet, nothing bad happens to him in the book, as far as I understand. His plan kind of fails,
And yeah, it's kind of like he's sort of how big money is treated, where he did a bunch of really bad stuff, but he has so much money that everyone kind of just says, hey, well, you know, he probably didn't really mean it. And by the way, you know, it's at the end, it's like, well, why should I use all my money to spend it on this stuff to save the day and to save the human race in the future? I guess I could, whatever.
I mean, his scheme doesn't really work, but it's not like he like really wins or loses, right?
Well, except that he's like living in a space station after like all this stuff happens on Earth, and he just like whatever. Yeah,
well, it's what he wanted anyway, right?
Yeah, he didn't cause the collapse of the entire freaking like world economy and stuff exactly, and like the governments and everything. But
he was promoting the terrorists that are destroying everything. He was kind of the evil mastermind behind it all, and instead he's bankrolling the happy future.
Hey, but it turns out that he loved his girlfriend / secretary or whoever that was, so it was okay he was abusing her during the book.
Tell me you're an exhibitionist.
Oh,
just
right.
Tell me you're an exhibitionist. You're an exhibitionist, right?
Yeah, that was really creepy. And then at the very end, she's happy and like potentially acts like she's in love with him because, you know, in one moment of, quote, weakness, as he puts it, he decides to trade his art treasures in a vault for her life, you know, or at least what he says. And he immediately has her change the combination before they can get in and steal them.
Right. He doesn't. He tells people a lie so they'll go away. They are idiots, so they believe him.
Right. And then she's like, oh, see, I knew that you were a good guy. You're like, wow, this was written to be a TV movie.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, that's the only way I got through this.
See, new billionaire project.
Yeah. But anyway, how about our hero? We've got David Adams, the genetically engineered genius who is immune to all diseases, including Legionnaire's disease, ladies and gentlemen.
And a complete idiot, apparently.
But he's not immune to women.
And he's got a computer interface in his head, which means that he's like us. He has an iPhone. And he's supposed to be basically Einstein with muscles. So what did you guys think of him?
I like the part where he got disconnected from the network and was basically an idiot from that point on.
He was an idiot before then, too. I mean, it's pretty obvious at the very beginning when he was like, what? Corporations don't interfere with politics. And the reporter's sort of like, are you kidding me? You're a complete idiot. And he's like, no, I'm going to be a forecaster. I could tell the future. And she's just like, whatever.
Have you ever forecasted anything?
No. I mean, kind of, but I wasn't totally right.
About to take a breath.
Yeah.
Look, it came true.
She's like, look, I'm going to knee you in the groin.
One of my pet peeves is when there's a character that's supposed to be a genius, but we only know he's a genius because people keep on talking about how smart he is all the time.
Right. I mean, there's the genius that is such a genius that it gets irritating.
Right.
But yeah, this kind of genius, the stupid genius, seems to be a lot more common. It's like maybe the everyman's supposed to identify with him because he's like fallible, but he certainly doesn't act like he's supposed to.
Well, it's really hard to write a super smart character because you, the author, know how the book is going to end, so you can see the solution that he's going to take. So it's hard to write somebody who's actually legitimately smart and not have them sort of be stumbling blindly through the narrative.
Right. I mean, it's sort of like Doctor Who or something where the writers kind of say it's actually difficult to write lots of scripts for Doctor Who because the character burns through half the plot like in the first 5 minutes, you know, compared to other scripts they write, and they're like, oh, okay, well, how do we get around this now?
To me, I mean, it's almost like he didn't really seem that smart because he spends most of the book gallivanting around the world with Scheherazade,
right?
And while every other character in the book is basically, you know, living out their sexual perversions with anything moving around them, he like somehow manages to fail at this until like near the end of the book.
I'm not sure. I think his sexual perversion is being taken prisoner.
Well, he also has that thing of escaping.
I had not considered those two things as his fetish.
That's my only explanation for this book, actually.
Yeah, like I was saying in our text, that I think that the new drinking game for this book is every time he escapes, then you take a drink. Because I swear it happened about 6 or 7 times that he was always escaping from something. And, you know, including the beginning when he's on the space colony, like, oh, can't go to Earth. And is like, you know, surrogate dad, you know, after he finally escapes, you know, it's like, it's the trope of, huh, good luck, son.
Yeah.
You know, I let you go. It was like, oh, God.
I had read this book a long, long time ago, probably when I was back in high school and thought that a lot of this was cool. So it's hard to remember, but you sort of look at it and it's just like, obviously, Cobb is letting him go. That's the only answer because Otherwise, why would you so obviously block off so many possible routes of escape, but leave one available?
Yeah, it's the only one that's left available to him. You know, that's kind of what was going through my mind as I was reading or listening to the book initially was, you know, it's like, well, here's the escape hatch. Glad you found it, David. Good job.
In the alternate version, he just suffocates and dies. In the packing capsule.
Much better book.
They're like, and then it ends after like a 2 hours. It's a novella, and then the editor made him tack on a bunch of crap at the end.
Reminds me of Kevin and my experience watching the movie AI, where we get to the sequence where the little robot is under the ocean, and
that's where the movie ended, right?
That's where
he's panning
ended.
Out, and you're
that's
like,
"Wow,
wow!" That's literally where I got up in the theater.
That's pretty hard
to leave, and then it kept going.
It's just like, what's happening? Anyway,
yeah,
So actually, my least favorite scene with David was he's got a big fight scene at the end, and at this point, the plot is actually picked up a bit because they've gone back to the space station, and you're starting to think, oh, well, maybe this book will like pull something out at the last minute and be kind of okay.
Right. David is returning to the space station after the PRU has essentially taken it over.
Right. First of all, David comes back. He's got an email terminal in his head, but firstly, he doesn't tell anyone that, oh, I'm part of a sneak attack. Right. Because, oh, they're not set up to handle this sort of thing. Right, so you just tell them and they just all, everybody hides in their houses?
Well, CC all. I'm coming back home, Mr. Prodigal Son!
I mean, it seemed pretty implausible that they built an entire space station that provides power for most of the planet that didn't have any type of, you know, defensive system.
Right.
Hey, it's just like, you know, the tire pressure monitoring system. You know, who would hack those things? Come on.
No, it's nothing like that.
I think that's how everyone would think about it, though. Like, what's the likelihood that someone would come up and try to do something?
Yeah, for a car that happens to hold the entire Earth's power supply in it.
They just say, don't go do that, you know.
I mean, it was kind of neat that they developed like a system of the space station generating solar power and then beaming it down to the planet, which was kind of interesting, right?
Sure.
I mean, it's been done before, but...
Yeah, and that was kind of one of the earlier things. And that's actually something that Benbow is particularly good at, is space station design, which is one of the things that drove me the most nuts was, okay, Benbow probably designed this whole space station, but then he thought for reasons that, oh, well, I want to make this to be a political thriller that mostly takes place on a future Earth that's mostly just the same as the 1970s America.
Yeah, like Barry said, there were things like that that, you know, oh yeah, this is some future stuff. And at the very end, we finally do get the, let's go off into space and save the human race by distributing, you know, to different planets or whatever. And it's like, if the whole book was that, this would have been freaking awesome.
Yeah. Why don't we just get the end?
It's like, just cut that out. It would be like a short story. It would be awesome, whatever. Like, but yeah, there were also the thing that kind of was bugging me. And I kind of half blocked it out of my head. It was like, you know, the chapter intros where it was like, you know, it was a nonfiction quote from some study about pretty soon everyone's going to die or we're not going to be able to produce anything and there's going to be bad stuff. And, you know, so it was like he had read all these reports and books about, you know, what was going to happen, predictions in the 70s. And so this is like his solution and kind of like this is a solution slash like what fictional version of these reports, right?
Right.
And so... I mean, I guess these were sort of like subtle footnotes or something. Like, I don't know what they were supposed to be other than to say, like, this isn't just me making stuff up. It could really happen.
Well, then there was also every chapter seemed to start out with James Cobb, notes for an unauthorized autobiography.
Yes.
And I had not actually connected that with Dr. Cobb for a while. So I was just like, what the hell is this supposed to be about?
I couldn't remember who it was even about the entire time. I was just like, whatever. And then they had the ones of the bright-eyed colonist kid that was just out of college or something. And
right.
He's like, I'm going to space, Ma.
And like, even that would have been a better novel. But since it was...
Right. If the entire thing was from his point of view or something bizarre like that.
Right. But since this was just randomly put into another narrative, then it just didn't work for me.
Yeah. Is there something about the late 70s that there's like this plotting political treatise genre or something like that?
Oh,
it really reminded me of this other book I'd read, which was also like I could barely get through. It was called The White Plague by Frank Herbert, I think. And like,
oh yeah,
and it was, that was 1982, so it was kind of, you know,
oh, yeah,
a few years
close
off. But that was like the same kind of, it was, you know, kind of up my alley, because it was like, look, it was an apocalyptic book and there was a plague of basically women become infertile. You know, it was sort of like an IRA, you know, terrorist kind of related thing. And it was like 20 hours of just like plodding through all this stuff. And you're like, God, you just make something.
I kind of wonder if there was an advance in bookbinding technology at the time, which meant that there was no longer any real limit to how long you could make novels and keep them relatively cheap.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if there was something unintentional like that, like, you know, the price of pulp paper or something like that, you know, where it was just sort of like, hey, people are starting to buy more books, let's just print longer ones or something. Like,
imagine
people think they're like more educated and cool because they're buying books.
Imagine David in analyst mode saying, okay, so the price of paper is going to drop precipitously, which will lead to the rise of extremely long political thrillers. So how about female characters? We've got a couple of female characters that are obviously really strong characters, right, guys? I mean, we've got Evelyn Hall, the plucky undercover reporter.
Yes, where the first thing she thinks of is how hot David is.
At length.
I believe that's the first 5 minutes of this book.
Yeah, basically. And her being sort of irritated by it, but she goes along with it anyway.
They intentionally picked David because they know that he'd, you know, arouse me.
His chiseled figure and like, oh, God, just...
He's hot and he knows it.
I wouldn't be able to control myself, which actually ended up being true.
Oh, but later on, you know, she reveals that when she's taken by the Hamoud, the tiger guy.
Yes.
And she's sort of his sex slave. She kind of reveals like, oh, well, she's learned that she can control men by pretending to be submissive and like learning stuff from them. So apparently she's just manipulative and it's okay or something. It was just, you know, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, what was that test, you know?
The Bechdel test.
Yes.
because there are two women in this book. We've got Bajat al-Hashimi, who's the daughter of one of the rulers of the world, who is secretly the PRU terrorist Scheherazade. And so she's naturally going to have a lot of thoughts and interesting opinions about freedom, and she's going to be motivated by political views, right?
You blew up my boyfriend. I'm going to... go become a terrorist.
Well, she was already a terrorist, but now she means it. It's not just right. a fun
now
game.
Now it's on.
Well, first she was a terrorist to piss off her daddy. Now she's a terrorist because her daddy blew up her boyfriend. And now she's fallen in love with David.
Look, her father was technically correct. No harm became of him while he was on the compound.
It's true. And he didn't kill her boyfriend. He hired somebody else to kill her boyfriend.
Right. The explosion killed him.
Exactly.
God. Maybe his small pieces of him raining to the ground were the other final part. I don't know.
But normally with the Bechdel test, the women simply don't talk to each other. Here, one of the women is actually holding the other prisoner, and yet they only talk about David and how dreamy he is the entire time and which one of them he loves.
And that was the other thing that it was so like soap opera. You were... David falls for the reporter, then she goes back to Earth, then he's hijacked by Scheherazade on the space shuttle.
Right.
Within a couple of weeks, you know, they fall for each other. They're hiking across, you know, wherever on foot. They're all in love. Then they meet back up with the other group who happens to have the reporter. Surprise. And the reporter's like, oh, I'm, you know, David, I found you again. I love you. And he's like, it's too late for that. He doesn't know what to do. He like, kind of gives her...
You missed how they hooked up with Leo again.
Oh, God.
They're trying to escape from New York. How can a... By the way, how can a novel be grainy? How can a novel have bad production values? I swear, they're like escaping through the sewer tunnels, and David says something about, you know, looking at a computer graphic of this, and somehow my brain sort of created that computer graphic and it was a faked up 70s looking computer graphic. This book is so 70s.
Maybe it was also complete with, you know, the Vaseline smeared over the lens to make it a soft porno film.
Oh, God. Pretty much. No, mostly I was imagining watching a third generation VHS dubbed copy of it.
Right. The tracking going off. So
yeah, there are a lot of coincidences that they use to try to stitch up these various narratives, because David and Bajat are trying to escape from a crazy New York, and they go to this harbor, and for no apparent reason, they pick this one particular boat that has Leo on
right.
it.
Oh, and God. he was looking for them, right?
I don't
he
know.
He was supposed to capture them and bring them back.
Maybe.
And I was like, well, that was sure convenient. That's what I thought too. And yeah. But yeah, so then the reporter comes back. David's like sort of awkward socially, like, you know, inexperienced, doesn't really want to do. So in order to kind of make the reporter feel better, he kind of like gives her a quick kiss or something. And well, guess what happens right then? Scheherazade walks in, kind of, you can tell the way it's written in the background. She sees everything and she's just like, and then her internal monologue is like, I was a fool to think that he can love an Arab or something, you know, like horrible like that. And I was just like, oh my God, like what?
Yeah, it was a soap opera. I mean, yeah, I was describing it.
It wasn't just a soap opera. Mm-hmm. It was like a white racist, horrible dream of a soap opera. Like if they envisioned like the end of the world, this is what it would be.
Oh yeah, it's a soap opera mixed with paranoid fantasy.
Well,
yeah.
Well, it definitely had the feeling of 80s, 70s, been before, and when they needed to have an ethnic character, or, you know, they just said, well, let's just take a white guy and slap some makeup on him. You know, and that's basically what this book felt like.
Yeah.
So is that where the term white ass in this book came from? Is oh, that yeah. They intend to put makeup on their asses?
Yeah.
Whitey also, that was in there.
Well, but whitey, that's at least slang I've heard somewhere else. Right.
That's like you said, that is slang that's commonly used.
Right.
You know, but, usually yeah. in jest or, I don't know, I guess for real in some places, but.
But yeah, in this book, we had Leo, the revolutionary leader that was originally employed, I think, by the world government.
Yeah.
He was an undercover agent of some kind, and then he got in too deep, and he discovered what real power was like on
those white asses are just out to get us.
And so, yeah, everybody's a white ass.
Except he was this football player who was hooked on steroids, and somehow wasn't one of the lead bad guys like his football coach or something like that? Or he like owned the football leagues or something?
Yeah, he was addicted to steroids and other, you know, nootropic, you know, mind.
Oh, and was taking melatonin to make his skin even blacker for reasons?
Because Shaft or something? I don't know. That's what it felt like. I mean, that part totally felt like this, you know, let's have our blaxploitation episode or whatever.
Well, yeah, it was even complete with, you know, the explanation of, you know, he was not just black, he was African black, and that's why the Italians call him eggplants. Like,
it was
what?
Right. Just an excuse to have a long discussion about people's different skin colors.
Well, he also did have a long discussion about, you know, what types of different foods that David got to eat now that he was on Earth, and he had to say, you know, I like duck the best.
Yeah, I love the fact that how he like slept under the star. David slept under the stars the first night after he got hijacked. They were back on Earth, and Scheherazade's like, come back in, you know, and then he's like, no, I got to sleep under the stars. And she kept thinking, what a fool he is. He's going to get sick. Like,
but he's impervious to disease. Oh, which comes in later. So David's master plan was to infect every one of his captors with Legionnaire's disease.
No, the entire space station.
Yes, the entire space station. So first of all, stupid plan.
I guess it's 50-50 if you're going to get to the people you actually want to save in time, but...
Yeah, I'm going to infect a colony with something that kills anybody over a certain age, pretty much, because it's essentially a bacterial pneumonia. And
I don't think they understood Legionnaire's disease at the time this book was written that well.
No, they certainly didn't when it started out, but they did know that it was fatal, obviously. So Legionnaire's disease was a disease that was sort of discovered with an outbreak after an American Legion meeting where a bunch of the Legionnaires attending it basically went home and had what were initially diagnosed as heart attacks, but it turned out that they basically were dying of pneumonia. So this was really topical at the time. In 1977, they had just discovered the bacteria that had actually caused it. What I don't think that they knew, or certainly isn't there in the book, is that Legionnaire's disease, turns out, is not contagious person to person. So,
right, isn't it usually just spread through
if they
like
drank
HVAC him. Systems or something? Or
yeah, it's through water and that sort of
well,
thing.
Well, they did drink his blood, you know, when he was out with the natives. Like,
there was a disturbing amount of blood play in this book.
Well, he was being a man then.
Oh, that was really
just like
weird.
Like his dad said, you came back a man.
Yeah, David went out with Bajat. Oh, they had been dropped off somewhere, and they had to make friends with the local tribe. So David cut his arm and put some of his blood in a bowl. And then the chief drank it and put some of his blood in a bowl and had David drink it, which, I mean, it was the 70s.
Yep. It's a bonding, male bonding ritual, I guess. But, and then, like, the only callback to that whole thing is that at the end he said, well, there's, like, this tribe that maybe we could stop their rainforest from being destroyed, or maybe we can just give them their own colony.
Yeah, you have to leave them alone.
Yeah, because some of my blood is in them.
That could be a spinoff TV series.
The David Blood Tribe.
God, D-Blood.
D-Bloods. Yeah.
Make it stop.
Just a little while longer.
Libertator will never stop.
Ah, yes. So there was a completely useless character in there who's the revolutionary leader, El Libertador, or as is weirdly pronounced through the entire book, El Libertator, which is not a word. I guess that's he was sort of based on Simón Bolívar or something.
Yeah, Simón Bolívar is sort of like the most recent in the series of people who have had this title, you know, going back to probably like the 13th century, it seems like, if I'm remembering correctly from the Wikipedia entry. But it's sort of a title that's bestowed upon people from Latin America / Spain that helped free them from, you know, various oppressors,
yeah,
things like that. And they sort of co-opted this title into the book.
Yes.
I really like Steve's co-opting the best where it's...
I decided to make him into a Mexican wrestler like El Santo.
So the entire book, and whenever he was talking, I sort of imagined you in like a terrifying, like tight outfit, you know, with the mask on, like screaming his lines or something.
I also did have a terrifying visualization when I, you know, walked out of the taqueria one day and there was that, what, 8-year-old kid in like sort of like a wrestler outfit. And I looked at him and I said, Steven?
Yeah, he was having fun running around.
Yeah, he was actually having fun. I was just terrified.
I'll have to say... The most frustrating thing about this sci-fi book was that it wasn't really a sci-fi book.
Well, yeah.
Until the last 30 minutes. And then, so when we hit that, basically after all the irritating stuff on Earth, all the build-up and the revolutionary stuff, which should have been a maybe 2 hours in the entire book, then...
Out of the 16 hours.
Yeah. Then they get back to the space station. That's where hour three maybe should have been.
Right.
And then they have like a little fight. David kills everybody or saves them, depending on what happened.
He's the last man on Island One.
Yeah.
Would have been if his Legionnaire's disease method had gone completely wrong and just everybody dies.
Everybody dies.
Oh, that's right. Since I'm a test tube baby, I don't catch diseases for some reason.
It'll be like that Star Trek episode where they have, you know, the Next Generation one, where they have active immune systems and like that causes this horrible disease that ages everybody. And that would have been an awesome ending to this where, yeah, everyone on there dies and then that stops all the power from space and so everyone on Earth is killed too, except for that tribe.
Right, that tribe, because they've got some of David's blood.
Yes. Oh, right. And then there'd be like this new super race or something bizarre like that.
It's the eighth race from Seven Eves.
Wow, so we can make a crossover fanfic.
It's the Davids.
Seven colonies.
It turns out that this was actually a secret colony in that universe, and they finally just stumble across this huge colony with just David in it and a lot of dead bodies.
He's like the face of Bo by then.
I can't die.
So after everyone's saved, you know, pretty much, then it goes into this like a 15-minute like science fiction final section where basically it's like, oh, well, you know, David's like surrogate father had this plan all along where he was squirreling away stuff to do like, you know, asteroid mining colonies. And like, because they had those interstitial things saying, you know, oh, there's like billions of dollars worth of resources in space just like waiting to be, you know, like this tiny, you know, bit of an asteroid the size of a car is like 99% gold and platinum and everything. And so you can just get, instead of, you know, millions of tons of stuff that you're having to ore on Earth, you just take a tiny bit and just send it back to Earth and say, here you go, you know.
So all he was missing was the Teclas.
Exactly. Yes. So basically it's almost foiled for a second because the billionaire who's still in charge apparently is like, well, why should I give you 75% of my profits? And then they're like, well, because otherwise we'll just declare ourselves a free colony. Like, and apparently that's the callback to the previous book was the moon colony that he like escapes from. That was what the previous book was about, and that also had Leo in it apparently.
God.
So yeah, anyway, so
let's listen to part one now.
Oh yes, I'm picking it next. So yeah, so that part, okay, that's the part I started really getting, you know, interested in. It's like, okay, we're gonna have, you know, Mars colonies are going to have space colonies, and this could be awesome. And, oh, well, we were just mentioning that this was going to happen in the future. Anyway, book's over now.
Yeah, it suddenly became one of those, and this is what's going to happen in the future, kids' books from the 1970s.
If only it had been illustrated.
Well, I've heard many times that science fiction is really writing about the time that it's in, but this is a book that really brought that home for me. There's this throwaway line at the beginning where they said, oh, Dr. Cobb hated to dress up in a formal suit. He particularly hated wearing the turtleneck and boots that goes with the formal suit.
Wow, I missed that. I guess that was a total 70s call out.
Oh, so you just think that this new fashion is just going to keep on going forever, right? It's not going to make people look like complete douchebags in the future.
How could that ever happen?
Yeah, I mean, also, David was a test tube baby, and 1978 was the year of the first test tube baby. Is there anything else that happened in that time that led to this book, do you think?
I don't think that there was any explicit mention of this in the book, but, you know, there was also a lot of nuclear testing going on, mm-hmm. you know, in the 70s. You sort of assume that this book was being written from about 75 to just before it was published.
Right. He had to spend some time on it.
Yeah. I think that sort of led to, like, sort of like the fear fomenting of the book.
Right.
Maybe.
Well, I mean, you know, Space 1999, that's probably the entire genesis, right?
It really does seem like Space 1999 now that I think about it.
Well, that was like 1975, 76, so.
Yeah, I mean.
They took something great and ruined it.
Is there anything else we wanted to talk about?
No.
No, I think I've managed to purge myself of everything I wanted to say about this book.
Yeah, I think I've repressed a lot of it, but I guess all I'd say is don't enjoy it, or rather, don't listen to it.
Enjoy every moment that you're not reading it.
Yes, if you're really, really into it, I guess all power to you.
Not all the power, please.
Okay.
And thus begins our hiatus from the 70s science fiction genre.
Hopefully.
I'll find something.
I'm going to go back in time and prevent the 70s from ever happening. This may involve a brief grandfather paradox. All right. Well, that's more than enough about Ben Bova's Colony. If you like this podcast or even feel neutral in a non-negative way, we'd appreciate a 5-star review on iTunes. You can give us a like on our Facebook page where you can find out about upcoming episodes, or send us an email at sf3podcast@gmail.com.
Is that the number 3 or is it spelled out?
It is indeed SF and the number 3 podcast.
Perfect. Our theme song is Love Amplifier by SafeWord, available on Magnatune. And until next time, we are Sci-Fi.
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 Yeah.
Thank God it's over.